All right. Good morning. So let me first just repeat Rabbi Schwartz's thanks to Stu Halperin and to Mordechai Cohen, Dr. Mordechai Cohen, for putting this together, and to Rabbi Schwartz and to OZ for hosting us and helping arrange this event. So my field is Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, and an issue that I've been working on and one that I will discuss today is the question of how Kabbalists evaluated the Rambam. And I think there's a sort of general perception that there's this great rift, maybe even two sort of dramatically different forms of Jewish thought, Kabbalist mystics on one side, the Rambam and the rationalists on the other side. But one of the things that I'd like to show today is that the issue and the matter is really somewhat more complex. And when you look closely, there's a lot of evidence of yes, places where the Kabbalists very much reject the Rambam, but also of striking examples of appropriation. Now, I should also begin by pointing out that there is this whole debate of whether the Rambam actually knew any Kabbalah himself. And the answer is absolutely clear that the Rambam had no access and had no knowledge of Kabbalistic sources or Kabbalistic traditions. So when you talk about the Rambam's view of Kabbalah, it's really a matter of guessing what the Rambam would have thought had the Rambam known Kabbalah. But when we talk about Kabbalist views of the Rambam, which is what we're talking about today, well, the Kabbalists, of course, had the Rambam in their hand, had his works, and they were able to make reasoned evaluations of the Rambam's material. There's a pool there. All right, but so having said the Rambam himself didn't know Kabbalah, you should at least be aware of a legend, which the earliest reference that I can find to this legend is in the 14th century by a little known figure named Yosef ben Shoshan, who wrote a commentary on Masechet Avot. And in this commentary on Masechet Avot, he describes back when he was a kid, so this is figure sometime in the beginning of the 14th century in Toledo in Spain, that he heard that a letter circulated in the name of the Rambam, that a letter was circulating in Toledo, where in this letter the Rambam wrote, and I'll read it to you in the English, he said, "Late in my life," this is the Rambam allegedly speaking, "a man came to me and told me sensible words," meaning words of Kabbalah, "and were it not for the fact that I was at the end of my days, I would change many interpretations in my work." So in other words, it's this letter purportedly by the Rambam, alleging that the Rambam, sort of on his deathbed, had, you know, charata about his life's work and great regret, and realized, in fact, Kabbalah is true and embraced Kabbalah. So this is the earliest example of this legend, but it has a lot of staying power. It repeats in numerous texts in various different varieties. So it's good to know that it's out there, but of course it's not true. But at the very least, it's indicative, I think, of the stature of the Rambam, right? I mean, even the Rambam's greatest enemies sort of wanted to claim the Rambam on their side. So that the Rambam at the end of his life, you know, secretly really was a Kabbalist, or in some versions, if you read his Guide to the Perplexed carefully, you'll even discover Kabbalistic traditions. All right. So what I'd like to do today is sort of my general outline for today is first to talk about what I see as one of the major points of contention between Kabbalah and the Rambam, and look at a couple of different sources that deal with this point. And then I want to go back to the very beginning of the history of Kabbalah, that is to say, the history of the very first Kabbalistic texts, the very first Kabbalistic writings that we have, and talk about the role of the Rambam in the production of those early materials. So, arguably, the most significant point of contention is the question of rationalism. Right, the Rambam believed that if you apply your human reason properly, right, if you go through the right set of arguments, follow the logical argumentations properly, you will arrive at truth. Right, the human intellect is built to enable a person to arrive at truth. Now, you could have a bad philosopher, right, who will make mistakes in reasoning, so he may not arrive at truth. But assuming you have a proficient philosopher who follows the laws and the rules of logic properly, so philosophical reason can get to truth. And that, of course, sets up the major problem of what happens when your rational truth collides with tradition, when the claim of tradition seems to be different than the claim of rational truth. And the Rambam, because he believes both that the rational truth is correct and that the traditional truth is correct, is forced to reconcile. But the form this reconciling takes is very much in the favor of reason, right? He argues that since reason must be correct and scripture must be correct, well, you have to read scripture allegorically to make it conform with reason. There's many, many examples of this. The classic example, of course, is anthropomorphism, right? The Bible is full of descriptions of God that seem anthropomorphic, right? God has, the Zerah Netuyah, whatever else. Yet the Rambam feels he can prove on logical grounds that God can't have a body. So what is he forced to do? Well, he's forced to take the literal words of Scripture and reinterpret them. Of course, he had plenty of precedent for doing so, but that is the argument he gives, right? Because we know rationally that God can't have a body, therefore, when we approach Scripture, biblical passages in the Torah that seem to say God has a body, we have to reinterpret them. The other example, which was really a great flashpoint in the debates over the Rambam and Kabbalah, was the question of creation. So the Rambam claims that the world was created. But the interesting thing is, he says that if you take the question of creation strictly on logical grounds, well, there's no proof either way. In other words, he goes through all of Aristotle's proof for the fact that the world was eternal, and he concludes that the Rambam thinks that the evidence is a little bit better for creation on the grounds of reason and logic, but it's not demonstrable, right? You can't prove it either way. And the striking statement that really was the source of a lot of uproar is the Rambam says very clearly that if someone should come up with a proof for the eternality of the universe, right, a proof that would show definitively on the basis of human reason that the world was eternal, then he would have no problem reinterpreting the beginning of Bereshit to make it conform with an eternal universe. He even says it would be easier to do that than it is to get around the problem of biblical anthropomorphism. So really a commitment to human reason. Now, Kabbalah arguably is the exact reverse. Kabbalah, of course, means tradition. The Kabbalists claim that they have traditions going back through the generations, right? Among the things that God gave to Moshe and Har Sinai was also Kabbalistic wisdom. And arguably, sort of key to the Kabbalistic point of view is that you have to, it's kind of a flight away from human reason, right? All that counts is tradition. Now, no one, of course, would say that the Kabbalists believe God has a body. The Kabbalists don't believe that God has a body. But the reason they believe God doesn't have a body, and the reason is because their tradition tells them so, right? Theoretically, if they had traditions that say God does have a body, they would be compelled, on their own reasoning, to accept that God has a body over and against the rational view. Now, in point of fact, though, when you begin to look through a variety of Kabbalistic documents, you see that really there are different stances towards rationalism. You're not going to find a Kabbalist who embraces rationalism in the same way that Maimonides or the whole rationalist tradition that he founded does. But you will find different stances towards rationalism. So that's what I want to look at. I want to look at two different stances in Kabbalistic literature, two different texts from disparate time periods that have two very, very different senses of the value of rationalism. All right, so the first text, and this is number one on your sheets, is from a figure named Shem Tov Ibn Shem Tov. He was a Spanish Kabbalist. His years are approximately 1380 to 1441. We have next to no details about his life, but we do know that he was radically and fervently anti-Maimonidean. Now here, before we look at this passage, some background is necessary. So he's living in the aftermath of 1391, and if you can think back to your Jewish history classes, 1391 in Spain was a time of these massive riots that really tore apart the Jewish community, devastated the Jewish community, and then followed in 1413 by the famous disputation at Tortosa, in the wake of which many Jews converted. So both after 1391 and after 1413, during this period of time, there was much apostasy. Right? Many Jews converted and embraced Christianity. And sort of one of the classic historical questions is, why is that the case? Especially compared to, say, the Crusades, right? The Crusades, you have all these great stories of martyrdom. Why is it that in Spain, in the 14th century, Jews embraced apostasy, converted to Christianity so much more willingly? And one response is the response of Yitzhak Ber, the great historian of Spanish Jewish history. And he argues that the answer has to do with the spread of Maimonidean philosophy, and especially Maimonidean philosophy in a radical guise, and it's sort of following the interpretation of Averroes. Now, Averroes was an Islamic philosopher who didn't interpret the Rambam, but he was a sort of a radical Aristotelian, and many people sort of adopted the radical Aristotelianism of Averroes and read the Rambam in that radical Aristotelian light. So that's Baer's evidence. That's Baer's claim, that that's what led to this mass apostasy. And you'll see why in a minute. Now, one of his proofs, one of his points of evidence, is Shem Tov ben Shem Tov, and his work called Sefer HaEmunot, and that's what you have in front of you, which is a long, extended critique of the Rambam. And you know, a few other philosophers we consider as following in the wake of Maimonides. Now, second point of preface here is that, as you may know, there are two different views among contemporary scholars of how to read the Rambam. So some contemporary scholars have argued that really the Rambam is, as he claims, a traditional Jew who tried to accommodate to philosophy where possible. And so creation is the greatest example, right? Rambam sees no evidence either way, so he chooses to believe in creation, and the same goes with a variety of other traditional Jewish dogmas, resurrection, divine providence, sachar ve'onesh, reward and punishment. Now, the other view, this is the so-called esoteric reading of the Rambam, is that the Rambam really just purported to be this traditional Jew for the masses. But that secretly, if you read his works properly, if you realize that his works, especially the Guide of the Perplexed, are esoterically encoded. If you sort of read between the lines, you'll see that he didn't really believe any of these core beliefs. So he may claim to believe in creation. He may claim he doesn't think that Aristotle really has a proof, but secretly, he doesn't believe in creation. And the same goes with reward and punishment and divine providence and triata metim and a whole variety of other issues. Now, what's not known is that this is not a new debate. This is actually a debate that was front and center in medieval interpretations of the Rambam as well. And Shem Tov ben Shem Tov is one who accepts the radical reading of the Rambam. In other words, he assumes that the Rambam is reading esoterically, and the Rambam does not believe in any of these basic aspects of Jewish tradition. So keep that in mind as we read this text. You'll see why that's important. Okay, so source number one here. So I'll read, and you can follow my translation. You know, maybe I'll read in Hebrew, and then I'll translate as I go. So when I investigated their words, insofar I was able, that is the words of the philosophers, a flame burned within me, because a malignant leprosy, a tzarat, had grown in the children of Israel. And this leprosy, of course, is the spread of Maimonidean philosophy. I saw that in all these generations, the philosophers were heretics and apostates. So in other words, he's saying that this is not a new phenomenon, that for a number of generations already, philosophers were becoming heretics, were becoming apostates, right? Jewish philosophers, followers of the Rambam, were choosing Christianity. So continuing, "V'en safek ki kasher takafunu atzarot u'gzerot hashta b'siba zu avda ki latenu kamifil palim v'amitchakmim azvu asuka." Right, and there is no doubt that now, when afflictions and decrees are upon us, the afflictions following 1391, it is for the following reason that our community has been destroyed. It is because the philosophers and wise men, really wise men is not a great translation, it's more like those who claim to be wise, I think Ber translates sophists, right? Those who purport to be wise. So, because wise men and philosophers left our tabernacle and burst its walls, and the multitude of our people followed them until our bones were dried up and our hope was lost. He's saying now what has happened is that it's not limited to the select philosophers who are choosing apostasy, but really the whole community, the Jewish community at large, has embraced these philosophic views. And what this embrace has led to is the destruction of our community, right? People have left the sukkah, right? Left the tabernacle of our community to embrace Christianity. So why is this the case? What is it about the acceptance of Maimonidean philosophy that has led to this state of affairs? So he explains.
כאחר שהסכימו שאין דין וחשבון על טוב ועל רע, ולטובים מהם יימשך השפע אחר התבוננותם בנמצאות, הנה הוא פנוי ויגיע אל מחוז חפצו בהיותו בן חורין ולא בהיותו עבד. Having decided that there is no judgment and recompense for good or bad behavior, and that the divine overflow will reach the best among them, that is, the best among the philosophers, after they philosophically contemplate the existences, they realize that they are free, and he means from the law, and that they can reach their desired state as free men rather than as slaves. So what's he saying here? He's saying that from this radical reading of the Rambam, from that point of view, there is no reward or punishment for behaving well or behaving badly on Jewish grounds. Right? God doesn't care if you keep Shabbos or if you keep kosher or any such event. What does God care about? What is the only way to get providence? And that's what he refers to as divine overflow, right? The shefa, which in philosophical literature refers to the divine flow, which is equivalent to a kind of divine providence. But the only way to get this kind of providence is through philosophically investigating, contemplating hanimsaot, the existences, right? Through philosophically investigating the world, right? By sitting and sort of thinking abstractly about philosophical issues. That's how you get divine providence. Keeping Shabbos, keeping kosher doesn't do the trick. And that's the only way. V'yagil mechos chavso, they'll reach their desired place being Olam Haba. The only way to Olam Haba is through being a philosopher, not through observing Torah and mitzvot. And what he's implying here is that if that's the point of view, so why does it matter if you're a Jew or a Christian, right? You can convert to Christianity and be involved in Christian rituals, but the Christian rituals are just as meaningless as the Jewish rituals. If all that counts is philosophically investigating God, it's philosophically contemplating the existences, well, you might as well be a Christian, right? You might as well save your life, be in a situation where you can, contemplate philosophy freely. Because who cares? So you're sitting at Mass, or you're sitting at the Shabbos table. None of it makes any difference. And it's a really very, very strong indictment on the part of a Kabbalist, and it's repeated elsewhere as well, of the philosophers and of Maimonides, that Maimonides simply does not have proper credence, does not allow for there to be sufficient meaning, especially in this radical reading of the Rambam, for the basics, for the particularities, for what makes Jews unique from non-Jews. And then just to finish the thought here, ובמנת השם העליון כבר התפקחתי עם מקצת המפולפלים מהם ומצאתים על דרך זה. So he says that he already argued regarding belief in the Most Holy Lord, Most High God, and he has found this to be the case. Meaning, apparently he's had these discussions with various philosophers, and he sees that this is what these Maimonidean followers really believe. ועשה כולי בבחייה גדולה מי יתן ראשי מים ואיני מקור דמעה ולזאת הסיבה עלה בדעתי זה ימים ושנים לחבר ולחקוק בספר איזה דבר נשאר בידי מדרכי התורה והקבלה אשר חכמים הגידו ולא כיחדו מאבותם. So I raised my voice in great crying, and he quotes from Yirmiyahu, "Oh that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears. For this reason, I decided many days and years ago to compose and inscribe in a book something of what remains in my hands from the Torah and the Kabbalah that the sages spoke and did not withhold from their fathers." Now, this is really a ta'ut in the printing. He really means not from their fathers, but from our fathers. But the earliest printed edition does say their fathers. But he means, in other words, that that Kabbalah has been passed down through the generations. The sages didn't withhold Kabbalistic knowledge from our forefathers, that is, from his forefathers. And now he has access to this Kabbalistic wisdom. And he's going to use this Kabbalistic wisdom. He's going to write down this Kabbalistic wisdom to sort of serve as a refutation or sort of a bulwark, I guess, against this advance of Maimonideanism. And you can see how this relates to this whole question of rationalism. Because part of what he's saying is that rationalism is by its nature universal, right? The tools of human logic are not Jewish or Christian or Islamic or anything else, right? They're absolutely universal. So that if the goal is being a philosopher, if the goal is to think rationally, then there's no need for particularism, for being this religion and that religion. You can be whatever religion you want as long as you embrace philosophical knowledge. And interestingly, then, if you go through the rest of his book, you'll find he doesn't engage the Rambam in philosophical terms. He doesn't try to show why the Rambam is wrong. He doesn't say, you know, I think, in fact, there is divine providence because the Rambam's logic was faulty and my logic is better. He doesn't do that. He says that the Rambam is wrong because I have a tradition that says he's wrong. And that is the entire tenor of his work. It's really a matter of positing this radical reading of the Rambam. And again, it's a radical reading. I'm not saying this is what the Rambam believed. This is a particular radical reading of the Rambam. Positing this radical reading of the Rambam against tradition that he's received, which he feels is the truth, which will defend against the inroads of philosophy. Okay, so that's our first text, this very radical anti-Maimonidean approach. The next text is number two on the sheet, is from Rav Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, one of the most important Mekubalim, Mekubal really of, you know, chief stature, lived in the 16th century, approximately 1522 to 1570. We don't know where he was born. He lived in Tzfat. He actually was very briefly overlapped with the Ari, and even taught the Ari for about a course of a few months before he died. Voluminous writer, sort of a synthesizer, really puts together just vast amounts of earlier Kabbalistic literature in organized forms, sort of gives you, you know, this is what Mekubalim believe in a kind of organized way. And the Ramak had much more use for philosophy than Shem Tov did. And you'll find that he quotes philosophical sources frequently and has, you know, a much more positive evaluation about them. Now, the source we're going to read now is from his work called Shi'ur Koma, Sefer Shi'ur Koma, which is really part of his commentary on the Zohar. It's a long commentary called Or Yakar on the Zohar, but this work was published separately as kind of a freestanding work. And you'll see his very, very complex relationship to rationality. Okay, so source number two. V'choshe dibru, you know what, actually, even before I read this, one more point of preface, is that the question of the Zohar. So as you may know, there's this question of when was the Zohar really composed, and there's a scholarly view that it was really composed in the 13th century, and then there's the traditional view that it's really an ancient work. But l'chulei alma, right, according to all sides of this debate, the Zohar wasn't revealed, didn't become public until the 13th century. Right, it wasn't known until the 13th century. So that, historically speaking, from either that scholarly point of view or the traditional point of view, the crucial impact of the Zohar did not emerge till after the 13th century. So you'll see why that's important here. Okay, so v'chol shedibru harodfim achar hayidiyah ha'elokit b'inyan ha'eloka tzedku b'mashe salkum imenu ha'ti'urim v'ha'pe'ulot. So all those who chase after knowledge of God by means of the intellect, said regarding divinity is correct when it comes to distancing attributes and actions from him. So whatever the philosopher is, and if you see the broader scope of his work, he's really talking primarily about the Rambam. So whatever the philosopher has said about distancing attributes and actions, meaning anything that might imply corporeality from God, attributes that may make God seem more human-like, actions that may make God seem more human-like. So anything they said by way of saying that God is incorporeal, that God does not have any bodily form. So they were correct about that. Amnam b'mashir etzu lomar b'hashgacha v'yedia v'yishar ha'inyanim natu min ha'derech ha'yishara mipnei shelo ha'ir aleim chochmat ha'kabalah. Regarding, however, what they desire to say about divine providence and divine knowledge, that means knowledge, God's knowledge of particulars, God's knowledge of what happens in the particularities of our world, and other such matters, they strayed from the correct path because the light of the wisdom of Kabbalah did not shine upon them. So they were correct about divine anthropomorphism, but they were incorrect when it came to things like divine providence, divine knowledge, and other such matters. Ve'ino min ha'tema, shehaya ha'sefer ha'zorar be'otam ha'yamim ne'elam ve'nistar, en chazon nifratz ve'hem chakru kefi yecholtam. Right, this is not surprising, because in those days the book of the Zohar was hidden and concealed. So the Rambam died in 1204, the Zohar wasn't published, wasn't revealed until the 13th century. So in the time of the Rambam, there was no Zohar. So it's not surprising that they would get these matters such as divine providence wrong, because they didn't have the Zohar. There was no frequent prophetic vision. The Zohar is almost given a status of a prophetic work. They had to investigate according to their ability. They had no choice. They didn't have the Zohar to tell them the truth. So they had no choice but to apply human reason to investigate God. V'yesh lehachzik lahem tova b'mar shirchiku unyanei hagashmiut v'kayotze bo mimenu v'amtu hadvarim min hasechel v'tahanot amitiyot. We should be thankful to them for distancing corporeality and what is related to it from God. They verified the correctness of these matters by means of the intellect and through correct arguments, and they place true beliefs in the hearts of those who are enlightened with God. So what he's saying is we actually need to be thankful. We owe a debt of gratitude to the philosophers for distancing corporeality from God. And remember, when the Rambam was writing about you shouldn't believe that God has a body, he wasn't writing this in vain, right? He was writing this because there were plenty of Jews, and we have ample evidence of this, who did believe God has a body, right? Who did have corporeal readings of God. So what the Ramak is saying here is, yes, we should be thankful to the philosophers for setting things straight, right? For making clear that God doesn't have a body. And we owe them a debt of gratitude. But regarding other things, they did not follow the correct path because the wisdom of Kabbalah was hidden from them. Right, you will not find in their statements which distance corporeality from God anything that you will not find stated even more emphatically in the words of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, the purported author of the Zohar, in a few places in the Faithful Shepherd, in the Tikkunim and the Idrot, and in a few other places. These are all different portions of the Zohar. The Raya Mehemna, the Tikkunim, and the Idrot. And these are places in the Zohar where Rav Shimon Bar Yochai himself states very strongly, you can't believe that God has a body. So in other words, he wants to make it clear that it's not only the philosophers who got this right, but when the Zohar did become revealed, you'll find this is correct in the Zohar too. And the reason this is important to stress is because there are certainly passages in the Zohar that do seem quite anthropomorphic. So he wants to make it clear that despite the fact that there are Kabbalistic works that make God seem pretty anthropomorphic, nevertheless, the Kabbalists agree and know, like the philosophers knew, that God doesn't have a body. But the major point here is that Ramak is not an anti-rationalist in the same order that Shem Tov ben Shem Tov was. Human reason, after all, does serve a function. Human reason, certainly until the time of the Zohar, was very valuable. But it had its limits. And one way to think of this, and this is clear from a variety of other passages in the Ramak's writing, is that from his point of view, the philosophers could tell you what God is not. And that is what the philosophers themselves claim, right? The Rambam's notion of negative attributes, that you can't say anything positive about God. You only can say what God isn't. So you can't say God is You can't even say God is alive, right? You can only say God is not dead. You can't say anything positive about God. So that's what the Ramak is saying. What the philosophers are able to do is tell you what God is not. They can tell you quite correctly that God is not a body, that God doesn't have any human attributes, but they can't go the next step. They can't tell you what God is. And to know what God is, well, there human reason breaks down. The only way to know what God is from a work like the Zohar, which tells you this is the nature of God, this is the nature of the Ten Sefirot, this is how divine providence works, this is how creation happened. Right? So all that philosophy can get you is what God is not. Now, one thing to notice here, though, is that, and this will become key for what I want to say in a moment, is that as far as the Ramak is concerned, both philosophers and Kabbalists are really after the same thing. They're really all after knowledge of God. Now, it may be the case that Ramak believes that he can get more knowledge of God than the philosophers can, but in terms of what they're after, right, everyone's after knowledge of God. And I'll tell you why this is important. This will now bring us back to the very beginnings of Kabbalah as a literary tradition. The first Kabbalistic works that we have were written in the 13th century. Now, this doesn't mean they were invented in the 13th century, but what happened in the 13th century was that these ancient traditions that had been transmitted for centuries orally, passed down generation to generation, were suddenly put into writing, were expanded, were elaborated, were put in systematic fashion, were sort of formed into this coherent doctrine which is available in writing. And the question is, why? In other words, what happened in the 13th century that made it so, that made these Kabbalists, who for generations had been secretive about their material, had never put it into writing, suddenly put it into writing? So one of the key theories is a theory of the scholar of Kabbalah named Moshe Idel. And he's written this in a variety of different places. It has to do with the works of the Rambam. And remember that prior to about the mid-12th century, philosophy, Jewish philosophy, was cultivated in Islamic countries, Islamic lands. Right? Jews in Christian countries didn't have access to philosophical material. It was written in Arabic. So southern France, Catalonia, this is where the first Kabbalistic documents were written. These were Christian countries, not Arabic-speaking countries. Traditionally, there was no philosophic tradition there. Starting in the middle of the 12th century, for a variety of reasons, largely because Jews from south of Spain, which was Islamic, were forced to flee from the Almohades, who was this pretty radical Islamic group. And these Jews who had to flee, many of them ended up in Christian countries to the north, both in Catalonia and, you know, right over the Pyrenees Mountains in southern France, where they were received enthusiastically, where they brought their culture with them. Some of them turned to become translators, translating classics of Arabic Jewish philosophy into Hebrew. And, you know, in this whole mix is of course the Rambam, right? The Rambam died in 1204. His Guide of the Perplexed was translated by a son of one of these immigrants from southern Spain in the same year that the Rambam died. And the Rambam's works caught on very, very quickly. In the 1230s already, we find this great Maimonidean controversy where all the communities, both in Catalonia and southern France, take sides, and some put the Rambam in Charem, and some put the Maimonideans in Charem, and the Kabbalists put the Maimonideans back in Charem, and there's sort of this vast mess of bands and counterbands. So what Idel points out is that the Rambam made a very radical claim when it came to the classics of Jewish esotericism. You may be familiar with the famous Mishnah in Chagiga that puts strictures on learning esoteric materials, right? It says you can only learn Maaseh Merkava, Maaseh Breshit, the account of creation, you know, in very limited settings. You can only learn, similarly, Maaseh Merkava, the account of the chariot. So what is this Maaseh Breshit, Maaseh Merkava? Well, you know, we don't really know what the content of this material was, but it presumably was esoteric interpretations of the beginning of Breshit and the first chapter of Yechezkel. So, you know, Yechezkel's chariot vision. Now, the Rambam claimed that he knew what Maaseh Breshit and Maaseh Merkava really were, and what they are is Aristotle. He makes it quite clear. If you want to know Maaseh Breshit, you want to know the account of creation, well, you should pick up Aristotle's Physics. If you want to know Maaseh Merkava, the account of the chariot, well, you should read Aristotle's Metaphysics. And what Idal argues is that this was a view that especially bothered the Kabbalists. Because the Kabbalists had their own traditions, which they believed were the true Maaseh Breshit and the true Maaseh Merkava. And part of this process of putting it into writing and putting it into a systematic form and elaborating and developing, he argues, was to kind of set the record straight. You know, you, the Rambam, and you, the Rambam's followers, think that Aristotle is the true Jewish esoteric material. As a matter of fact, we have this true material, and here it is. So that's the view of Idel. It is a view that has a lot of very good evidence to support it. And you don't have time to look at some of that evidence today, but there are a number of important passages in early Kabbalistic literature which lend credence to this view. But one of the things that I've been writing on now and working on recently is that as much as that's true, it shouldn't obscure the way in which the Rambam and this whole influx of philosophical literature was also a positive catalyst, not just a negative catalyst, but also a positive catalyst. This whole development of Kabbalistic literature, to the putting it into writing, to the expanding, to the developing. This has to do with really a pretty basic question, but what is the goal of human life? What are you here to do? And the view of the philosophers is you are here to basically contemplate God, right? You're insofar as it's possible. I mean, that's the goal of life. The goal of life is to be one who contemplates God, to apprehend God, to gain knowledge of God. Divine love is defined in terms of one who knows God philosophically is able to love God. You can't daven properly until you have proper philosophic knowledge of God, etc., etc. And this really is a chidush of philosophical literature. This is simply not a value that you can find in Chazal. And you can take my word for it, but I spent a long time now looking for statements in rabbinic literature that seem to say the key point of life is to investigate God, and you won't find them. And the whole range of psukim that the philosophers quote to support this view simply are not used that way in traditional rabbinic literature. So this is really sort of part and parcel of a new philosophic kind of appreciation of Judaism. Maybe not in contradiction to rabbinic Judaism, to Chazal, but a value which is not native to Chazal. And the really interesting thing is that the first Mikubalim very much adopted the same value. You read through their writings, the same sukim, the same language, the same lashon, where also investigating God is made the sort of chief concern of what it means to be a Kabbalist, what it means to be a Jew. It means to be a Jew, ultimately. And one of the things that I think happened is that part of this concern was what led the Kabbalists to say, wait a minute, we have these traditions which talk about God. So now we know there's an imperative to study God. There's this great value to investigate God. Well, what do our traditions have to say about it? How can we take our traditions? How can we develop them? How can we work them out with philosophic ideas about God? And I think that process, as much as the negative catalyst of the Rambam, the positive catalyst was also, I think, somewhat determinative of this production of Kabbalistic material. And just look at one short text, this is number 3, of many such texts that could prove this point, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions. So this is a work by Rav Asher ben David. So the person who was regarded by later Mikubalim as the father of Kabbalah was Yitzhak Sagi Nahor, who was the uncle of Asher ben David, and the son, which makes Rav Asher ben David the grandson of the Ravid who you're probably familiar with. So this work, Sefer Yichud, is one of the very first Kabbalistic works written, perhaps the third or fourth Kabbalistic text ever written. And in this little short passage I give you here, he explains why he wrote it. So here's what he says. Hachol hakol birarti uferashti lachol mevinu maskil davar davur al afnav lefi shenitztavenu bedat Moshe Rabbeinu le'avat Hashem Elokeinu v'liyira mimenu v'ladat b'reinu
כמו שנאמר, וידעת היום והשבות אל לבבך, כי השם הוא האלוקים. בעבור זה, הזירנו משה רבנו והנביאים ומשיח צדקנו להכיר יוצרנו ולהבין ולהשכיל על קוננו וללכת בדרכיו ולהדביק ביריו, ואם לא נחפש ולא נחקור אחריו, איך נקיים בלבב שלם את דבריו אם לא נכירהו, ואיך נתנהג במידותיו אם לא נדעהו. Just quickly to read the English, I have clarified and explained all this to every person of understanding, and to every enlightened person, each matter as is appropriate, because we were commanded according to the faith of Moses our rabbi, to love God, to fear him, and to know our Creator. As it is said, know this day, and keep in mind that the Lord alone is God. For this reason, Moses our rabbi, and the prophets, and the righteous Messiah, that is King David, warned us to recognize our Creator, and understand and study our Maker, to follow his ways, and to cleave to those who fear him. And if we do not search and investigate after him, how can we fulfill his words with a complete heart? How can we do so if we do not recognize him? How can we behave according to his attributes if we do not believe him? So that's why he wrote the text, right? He wrote his text to clarify basic matters about the nature of God. And, you know, if you would cover up the title of who wrote this and you know, tell me this came from the Rambam or any one of the Rambam's followers in southern France, I would very readily believe you, because you can find really the same rhetoric, the same words, the same psukim, quoted in all these sources. So let me just, by way of conclusion, make the following comment. That, yes, there were certainly radical differences between philosophers and Kabbalists, and we saw that really a chief difference is this different evaluation of rationalism. Although even there, we saw some were more inclined towards a rationalistic view, and some were less inclined. But in some ways, on a more fundamental level, right, the basic project of Kabbalah, what Kabbalists do, right, this goal to investigate God, to understand God, is a goal to which they're indebted to the Rambam for it in very strong ways. So that whatever the disputes between them, there is a real way in which the Rambam is instrumental, I think, in the development of Kabbalah. So I'll leave it at that. I think we have a few minutes for questions before the next session. So please.
Similarity or parallel between the Rambam vis-a-vis Kabbalah and his son, Albert Ramakar Maimon vis-a-vis Sufism, where, if I pronounce it right, Rebel was a professor who was visiting to insist that indeed.
Paul Fenton, yeah.
Which I find really untenable. I mean, Rabbeinu Avraham might have found within Sufism certain normative values or that are, you know, consistent with normative Judaism, but I don't see how he could have adopted the more spiritual, mystic elements of Sufism. And I was wondering, when you mentioned, maybe I misunderstood, that you said, I think philosophy is a universal concept, but I think mysticism is the universal concept. I mean, I think that within the realm of mysticism, you find non-Jews who are obviously comfortable in that same realm. And I was thinking, when you mentioned the Zohar as at least appearing or being influential in the 13th century, the 13th century was also the period in Europe, Christian Europe, in which the Talmud was burned.
Right. Well, the Zohar was
embodies reason, and maybe there's some connection between the rejection in the Christian world of the strict legal, rational ethos of Judaism and their spiritual, you know, otherworldliness.
Yeah. So on the son of the Rambam, from my point of view, Paul Fenton makes a convincing argument. But it's a matter of going through the literature and seeing what you think. I don't think it's sort of a priori surprising that a Jewish thinker would adopt a foreign system of spirituality. I mean, it happens. It happens. The very first philosophic source of Sadia is really a sort of a Kalam manual, and similarly Chovot HaLevavot, which also there's a new book out on Chovot HaLevavot by Bachi Ibn Pekuda, which also shows, again, to my mind, convincingly, really strong Sufi influences. Now, on the question of the universalism versus the kind of particularism, so you're sort of raising a broader question, which is how appropriate is the term mysticism for Kabbalah, which is a term I use because that's the term that's been used. But recently, one of the things that sort of is on the front burner of Kabbalah scholarship right now
after a few recent articles, is this term mysticism even appropriate? I mean, are the Kabbalists primarily mystics? Or are they primarily esotericists or traditionalists? Or what is the right word? Because part of the way that the Mukabalim, and this is a sort of part of a, also the question of the debate with the Rambam, is Tameh HaMitzvot, which is central. You know, some of you probably know this to some extent through the Ramban, but there's much more literature about this, is that for the Rambam, for Maimonides, the mitzvot had social values, right? So, you know, the classic example, of course, is the korbanot, right? So why are the korbanot? Because the Jews, because the Israel wasn't ready yet for a situation where there wouldn't be korbanot. And, you know, then the Rambam goes through the whole, through this whole set of literature, which he believed to be ancient literature, where he thinks he understands the reasons why the Torah legislates various laws. Well, you know, they legislate shatnez to fight, you know, this particular pagan view. So that everything is sort of socially defined. And theoretically, when those social circumstances don't apply anymore, well then, you know, why keep Torah and mitzvot? Now the Rambam never says that, and I'm not aware of a single Maimonidean philosopher who says that, although in the Maimonidean controversy, one of the major accusations was that there were Maimonideans not keeping halacha for that reason, whereas Kabbalah has a totally different account of Tamei HaMitzvot. For Kabbalah, the reason you keep the commandments involves the effect they have on the divine world. Right? By keeping the mitzvot with the proper intentions, with the proper kavanot, you're going to create various influences in the divine world. You're going to bring together the sefirot in their appropriate configurations, which means that the particularities of mitzvot, how you do them, if you do them properly, right? If you don't walk back three steps the right way when you're before the Amidah prayer, and you don't put on your tefillin the right way, you've from a Kabbalistic point of view threatened to cause real damage in that divine world. So the really particularities of Jewish tradition come to be extremely central to sort of supporting the whole cosmos. All right.
Were those who were antagonistic against the Rambam, were they aware of his 13 principles?
Were they aware of his 13 principles? Yes, certainly. Look, I mean, from the point of view of the radical reading of the Rambam that I mentioned, which you can find already shortly after the Rambam's death, I mean, basically, the argument would be, although I don't know if it's stated quite in these terms, is that they're not true. The Rambam didn't really believe them. The whole 13 principles are strictly for the masses. Now, insofar as the more moderate readings of the Rambam, so yeah, I don't think the Kabbalists had any particular disputes with any of those principles. I mean, you know, they may understand their meaning differently. In other words, divine unity. So the Kabbalists may have a different understanding of divine unity, but it wasn't difficult to reconcile sort of the claim for divine unity in the 13 principles with a Kabbalistic view.
Well, some of the principles don't seem to be so rational. And why wouldn't that more harmonize?
So for example...
Well,
yeah. Well, I mean, as you know, that was one of the major things that the very first round of debate against the Rambam was: did he really believe in Tchiyat HaMetim? And he was accused for not believing in it,
right.
and he had to write this Mamar Tchiyat HaMetim, where he said, "No, I really do believe in Tchiyat HaMetim." But for many observers at the time, it wasn't convincing. Right? The Rambam secretly couldn't have really believed in it on rational grounds, and he really only was saying it for the masses. Again, I'm not saying that's what he thought, but that certainly was both today and historically an important reading. And the Tchiyat HaMetim comes up over and over. In other words, the Mamar Tchiyat HaMetim didn't do the trick. People still questioned even after that whether he really believed. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
We're moving away from the Rambam to more mystical beliefs today.
We're moving away from the Rambam to more mystical beliefs today. It's a tough question. Depends who and where, I think, is part of the answer. There is, just in the point of Kabbalah itself, there is an unbelievable revival of Kabbalah in Haredi and Hasidic circles. And one of the ways in which this is manifest is the things that are being printed, right? I mean, there are things that are being printed in very small runs of Kabbalistic manuscripts that, you know, for the past 50 years have been known by nobody except a few scholars. All the works of Avram Abulafia, for example, have been printed. This text here, actually what an interesting case. This Asher ben David here is from, I took it from the Critical Scholarly Edition. It also appeared recently in a traditional edition, which as far as I can tell is a directly plagiarizes from this edition, from the Critical Edition. So there's a lot of revival from that point of view. But I think sort of a broader way to think about this is that there's been a move away from the Rambam's philosophical point of view in general, if it ever really caught on, and that there are very, very few Jews today, and maybe this is more pronounced in the Haredi world than the modern Orthodox world, but there are very, very few Jews today who could really be called Maimonideans in a sense of the term that the Rambam would agree with. But from that point of view, I don't know if it's as much of an embrace of the Rambam, but more an embrace, I mean, I see it more of an embrace of the Kuzari, if that's helpful. Not of strictly mystical literature, but of a sort of a different ideology, which is you know, anti the sort of scientific value of scientific and rational knowledge that the Rambam had, and more in line with a sort of more particularist view that you find in Yehuda Alevi's Kuzari. I think we maybe have time for one more quick question. Good, all right. So thank you.